Myanmar, the long shadow of the hunter, is a topic for discussion where we will hear for half an hour from Tan Sri Razali Ismail, after which a dear friend here, Dr. Zani, will be the commentator and lead the discussion and the Q&A that will follow. Of course, at the LSE, we are quite passionate in wanting to understand the cause, the causes of things, and not just as they are, or why they are, but also why they don't change. And in respect of Myanmar, or Burma, it was called before 1989, it's been a long story, a very long story indeed, and there might be some signs of change, but there had always been signs of change even before then. And Tan Sri Razali Ismail is eminently suited to discuss with us his experience when he was the Kofi Annan special representative to Myanmar from 2000 to 2005, 2004, and then to reflect from that experience what kind of regime one's dealing with, the political situation there, the persons involved, and the political processes that he perceived then. I do not want to anticipate what he is going to focus on, but I imagine from a practitioner's point of view, he will relate to us how he went through that experience, after which Zani will start the conference. So, Tan Sri is sort of an eminent person who had an illustrious diplomatic career in Malaysia, for Malaysia, where he distinguished himself at the United Nations, and on his return he was special advisor to the Prime Minister, and he continues to be involved in thinking about international affairs, although he has also some involvement in the private sector. So, Tan Sri, please, take the floor.
This is for me, right?
Yeah.
Good evening. I should be grateful to be brought here to the LSE. But there's such a dramatic title to the subject we're dealing with, the long arm of the military or whatever. Long shadow, is it? It's a bit difficult to deal with it in such bold terms. And I think whatever I've written is not really going to be very helpful either. And I should tell you that I don't have anything new that I can talk about. Reminiscences, yes, of course I have. We can talk about that if they are helpful. But there are no special prescriptions, no insight. Deep insight into whatever can be done. But I can say that the international concern, interest on Myanmar has always been there. It has never gone down. And it has to do with Aung San Suu Kyi, it has to do with several other factors. But and also that Myanmar sort of has caught hold of a lot of people's imagination, countries, also the conscience of certain countries, like Britain, never finished the job in Myanmar. Just cobbled together Myanmar and India and left it like that. And the ethnics were not really looked at properly, and there's a lot of things that have not been done. And you look at it now, after 60 years, you have a lot of work that has to be done. You know, this is the country that should have moved better than Cambodia, whatever. Even Cambodia could have national reconciliation. We are not able to do this in Myanmar. Although the structures in Myanmar were much more entrenched, more consolidated. But this is a country that suddenly has come out and the job's not done. And there are 54 million people there in Myanmar, even perhaps even more. And some of them have come out to Malaysia, to Singapore, to Thailand, along the border, the Karens, the Kachins are out there as refugees. In Malaysia, we have at least 50,000-60,000 Rohingyas, people that have been displaced internally, who are out there, neither in economic migrant nor political refugees, without any status. And their families have more children, and the government of Malaysia, for example, for their own reasons, is not able to guarantee them anything. So I deal with some of the orphanages that in Malaysia that deal with street children, and we do find children from the Rohingyas who have no status whatsoever. So it's not just the attention on Myanmar. It has come very close to South Asia, although the governments of Israel refuse to recognize the enormity of the problems that they have. If the ethnic, for example, cannot be put together, even after the roadmap and the elections and all the next year, if it happens, then would those people go back to their arms, and would there be a lot of fight? And this would mean a lot of instability in South Asia. And the Chinese have good reason also to be very worried about such instability. Then, of course, the trial of Aung San Suu Kyi made a lot of headlines. Now everybody's trying to make every kind of interpretation to what Hillary Clinton meant when she talked about the changed position of the United States, that there will be sanctions, but the United States would want to deal directly with the military, the SPDC. And everybody's more or less, everybody has jumped on this. This is the way out. I can tell you that many years ago, when I was dealing with it, 2000 and 2004, 4 years ago, in one desperate moment, without getting anywhere, I had talked to Lieutenant General Kinyon, and I said to him, what is it that the military wants? Put it all on the table, everything you want, put your card on the table. Including even a guarantee from prosecution, you know, and whatever important gains they have in Swiss banks or whatever, that too can be factored in. And ASEAN would have a cordon sanitaire. I mean, they are guaranteed they can move about freely, you know, crime against humanity and all that. And I said, why don't we just, let me bring the IMF and try to stabilize your currency or whatever. He gave me a very enigmatic kind of a silence. He said, you fool, you think it's that easy, you know? So he never gave me an answer. Then I talked to Jim Kelly. Jim Kelly was in the time of the National Security Council of the United States. He was already taking steps to meet the North Koreans. So I told him, Jim, why don't you look at the problems in Myanmar in the same equation as you look at the problem in North Korea? And he said that, again, he's very dismissive. He said that, these people are thugs and crooks. Yeah, but obviously, nuclear bombs are more important than human rights to the United States then. But now there's a change of perspective in the United States. If Mr. Obama is for real, and quite a lot of people feel that he's for real, then there will be palpable steps taken to see how they can engage with the military, however obnoxious to them it had been before, to do something about moving the situation, improving the situation. So we have got Mr. Obama has got to be given at least a prima facie case that he's genuine, he wants to do it. Okay. But there are lots of baggages that the Americans have that they have to deal with. The Americans of the Bush era never allowed for any kind of maverick thinking on dealing with Myanmar. It was sanctions more punitive measures and more sanctions until these people crack, like some African country. But they were looking like that. And I think at that time, the strategic considerations of Myanmar to the United States was not apparent, even if they were very clear to India and China and all that, and to ASEAN. But the Americans didn't want to expend energy beyond just taking a high-profile position publicly, condemning Myanmar more and more. So it didn't lead anywhere. Now there is a chance, but they have a baggage. They have thousands and thousands of fan club of Aung San Suu Kyi out there in Washington. When I was the special envoy, I had to deal with these people, and they would follow every step what you do to make sure that you do not deviate from the holy book what they wanted to be done. That is, Aung San Suu Kyi must be released. Some of them would even contend that you have to go back to the elections of 1990, when the National League for Democracy won very handsomely. And that it would be the starting point of national reconciliation. Completely unrealistic. So that baggage is still there. And I do not know how courageous would the people of State Department now, how willing would they be to want to not deal with that. I'm sure if there is going to be an improvement on the quality of discussion between the generals and the State Department, you cannot avoid the issue of Aung San Suu Kyi. But it could be a kiss of death, because people like Senior General Tang Shui and others just cannot imagine that they can discuss seriously about Aung San Suu Kyi. I remember that I completely underestimated the sense of distrust, of mistrust that he had for the other people in the junta had for Aung San Suu Kyi. There was a time when I was talking to him, to Senior General Tang Shui, and there were Kin Yun and a few others, Mong Hae. And I had been forewarned, don't press this point too much about her, talk about something else. And I stubbornly kept doing it. And he stood up. He stood up from the meeting and said, I've got other things to do, I've got to go. Kin Yun will deal with you. As dramatic as that, and what could I do? And I think it was also the beginning of the end for me. But they came to the conclusion that I was less than impartial. But the problem has got to be faced now, because if the Americans, anybody, right? If Western Europe is the same, they have a whole baggage of prisoners of that situation. Everybody talks about Aung San Suu Kyi, the way out, the national reconciliation being Aung San Suu Kyi must be a factor, a very important factor. But I suspect that if you want to deal with national reconciliation, in the first place, if you look at the roadmap, the national reconciliation that the UN had envisaged, that naive guys like me had envisaged, that there will be the military, there will be the ethnic groups, and there will be NLD, led by Aung San Suu Kyi, working in a tripartite discussion. That thing never took place. The military never wanted to bring the ethnic groups into the discussion. On my second visit to Myanmar, General Tang Shui agreed to talk. All I said, just talk to Aung San Suu Kyi. And they agreed to talk. He appointed Lieutenant General Kin Yun to do it. But they talked very privately. The U.S. not supposed to interfere or be facilitating openly. And the ethnic groups were not supposed to party to these talks. They will, if they have an equation, they can agree to, these two parties would then bring in the third party. So national reconciliation never took place. And the naivety of it, the UN and I and everybody went along with it. We thought we could do it. We could persuade the government to agree to accept there can be national reconciliation. And of course, as you have all known, now there is the roadmap. He's done the referendum. He's got the constitution. There's been a referendum. 99% have accepted it. And next year, there may well be the elections. And what is tragic or realistic is that the countries in that region, and possibly everybody else, despite the scathing attacks and whatever and all that, will acquiesce to that results of that election, which is heavily flawed. Sisi will not be affected there, and NLD will not be allowed to take part in it and all that. Unless Mr. Obama can make the changes in the next so many months. So that is a huge enterprise. Delicate mix between engaging with them, keeping the sanctions going, and pushing them, coaxing them along to take a certain path that in turn can be rewarded by aspects of development. Because the country really has to develop. The country is like 45 years behind what Malaysia is now. They do not even have, one of the things that Aung San Suu Kyi pointed out to me, they do not even have technical schools. When the British left us, with something, not everything, but something, technical schools, where we learned how to deal with hammer and nails and screwdrivers and all that. And that was the bedrock of a whole generation of people that became technical. New technical things. So they don't have that in Myanmar. Suddenly, if you are thinking of catapulting in IT into Myanmar, you're just jumping, right? Making a leap jump like that. It's not going to work because the basic block by block training has not taken place. So, Aung San Suu Kyi wanted that to happen. And so they're very, very far behind. And it suits the strategy and design, the interests of countries like India and China. I have tried so hard to talk to China I don't know whether I'm making any sense, but I'm jumping here and there, but you just have to bear this for the next 15 minutes or so. But I've tried so hard to get China to come up and say, follow us as an example. We are autocratic, centralized leadership, but we give people benefits. If you have been to China in the 70s during the Red Guard Revolution, you would have seen, and I've been there, and the difference after that when the Chinese came out with beautiful clothes and jeans and this and that, because they're getting the benefits of development, wise policies. But in the case of Myanmar, you have ministers that are generals who didn't know anything about the portfolio they had carried. So there were no benefits to the people. A lot of money was made, but kept outside, particularly gas and petroleum. They were kept in escrow in the Singapore ambassador, possibly in Singapore, as well as in Kuala Lumpur, to some extent. we did the money trail. I think, what is it about the British? They're quite sophisticated. So we asked them to do certain dirty tactics, so to find out how we can put the pressure. And we followed the money trail, not conclusively, but we knew a lot of money has been kept in that area. I think it's like probably over $300 million a year. It's not taken back to the States, to the country, but kept outside, mostly in Singapore. So, where am I now? I was special effort for 4 years. I went, the Taipei incident started in late 2003. I knew this was the end of this. They tried to seriously injure Aung San Suu Kyi and group. This action was a desperate effort by the senior leadership in Myanmar, the generals, to. They made a mistake because they allowed her to get out of detention, but they didn't talk to her. I mean, I had not I. I mean, it's got nothing to do with me, but I mean, the logic of it, I made was, you just can't let this, her go out and then not discuss with her. This was a very flawed thing to do, because the moment she went out, she didn't, even now I would say, and I would say this to anybody, that she's not worried about her personal freedom. She's not in the least worried about personal freedom. She's worried about, she could stay for the next 20 years in prison or in detention, as long as she underlines the point that something must be done about the people. This is what she wanted to do. I'm not trying to make her some tragic figure, Joan of Arc, and like that, but that's the commodity you're dealing with. Sometimes it is difficult to deal with it because it's so highly principled. And it took a lot of effort, some of us, to bring her down from her high horse. I remember one told her that, you know this, and you would be able, I was quite impressed, you'd be able to give the other prime ministers of ASEAN a run for their money. Because I thought, if you are incarcerated in the house, you have only one SW radio, you're listening to BBC, how can you keep up with things that are happening? But the lady knew these things, and was in touch about IT, she knew about DNA, she knew about lots of things. And she was, at the same time, also trying to rewrite the Constitution of Myanmar. So I was very impressed with that person. But because she is like that, it's very difficult to have a measure of the person. But I have very strong affection for her. But I doubt that she will actually be, as it were, Prime Minister of Myanmar. The time has passed. And the equation for national reconciliation, if you want to get the military to agree to changes, she cannot be a dominant factor in that. And somebody is going to castigate me on this, but she cannot. She may be the Gandhi and not Nehru. She's a national leader in that context. I think she will do it. It is politic to have her not be involved directly with the NLD. But the problem is there is nobody else. There's nobody else. I mean, if the military has completely excoriated the old structures, the monasteries are not there. There are the monasteries, but there's no traditional leadership. No traditional in the villages. And they have demonized them to the young generation and to the military, that 500,000 soldiers. They've made up the case that she is a big problem to them. So, comes to Obama, versus Hillary Clinton. How do they make these things happen? But everybody else in the world is expecting something to happen out of this, and it has to happen quite quickly. I suspect things can move. Just now I spoke to somebody from Foreign Office here, Mr. Scott Whiteman, and we talked about it, and they sought my views. The thing is not to make the mistakes that we made. But one of the mistakes we made, we completely underestimated, including Aung San Suu Kyi, she underestimated the critical value of Lieutenant General Kim Yeol. She thought that this is just a voice of the military, yes man, following the orders of the boss. You know, we never really protected him. And now he's not there. We know where to begin. At that time, the Americans were interested in at the UN to seriously reduce opium in the cultivation of opium in Myanmar. And Kim Yeol seriously went into it, including with the blessing of Tang Shui. And the UN acknowledged formally that opium cultivation had been significantly reduced in Myanmar. But the Americans, because of politics, didn't want to formalize and support that. And Kim Yeol was burned by the rest of the general by going along with the Americans, and then he was not acknowledged to have reduce the population of opium. That was the beginning of attempt to take Kinil out of the equation. And of course, it's not done. And how do we find people that are progressive enough and look to the international scene to find a place for their country? At this moment, all, even the younger ones, what is the prime minister?
Tencent
and Schuman and all this. They just like the old man. They're just like the senior general, even more so. So it's going to be a huge, huge problem. So the role of Aung San Suu Kyi is still very much needed. I'm not one of those people who thinks that she's becoming less and less relevant. She's going to be less relevant in some ways, but she's going to be more and more relevant in also radiating and bringing up and making the people understand the modus vivendi that will have to be established between the generals and the people in terms of phasing in democratic governance. It will take a lot of effort. And we've got to get the Chinese to think outside of the box. The idea of looking at the thing is to see what is in their best interest. And there are lots, thousands of Chinese business people already flooding in Mandalay and places like that. And they want to come to have a strategic interest consolidated in Myanmar. So are the Indians. This is why we could never get the support of these two important countries. It's a lot to be expected. I don't know how this is all going to be panned out, how this is going to come out in reality. But the fact that Mr. Obama has put this out, that he will try this special mix of negotiating at the same time maintaining sanctions, that's a good beginning. I have no special prescription to say, but we mustn't make the mistakes that we made before. And one of the things that we'll mistake is, again, to overemphasize this iconic role of Aung San Suu Kyi. I mean, I have strong affection for her, but I know if I am ever given a chance again to go back, I would plead to her to de-emphasize her role, to give more place, more involvement of other people. Humanitarian effort must be made. We have to stabilize the whole economy. The IMF has done it, but nobody has had the courage to go and give it to the senior general. So bring it to the lying down, moribund, like 10 years. There are so many things that have been just shoved into a drawer and not benefited the people. Okay. Was it 20 minutes or 15 minutes?
We've got another 5 minutes.
Okay. I think a breather. But let's have I'm not using my notes, so let's have the discussion. Some of you have been there, have a sense of partiality this way or that way. Zani, you're from there. You've been activists like you before. And there are quite a few very significant people out in Canada, in Thailand, in Western Europe. One time you were activists. And now perhaps you could be honest brokers. You could go back there and explain to the generals. But a lot of effort has to be made. Thank you.
Thank you. We now have... thank you, Dr. We now have... Zani, who, as many of you know, is research fellow in Burma at the Center for Global Governance. Many of you would also know his perspectives because he's been on BBC and been publishing a fair amount since recently, particularly in response to events that have been taking place. So Zani will begin to lead the discussion for all of us, and then we'll have plenty of time, you know, for about half an hour at least. For Q&A and discussion. So Zani will speak for about 20 minutes. Do you want to speak from here?
Yeah, I can speak from here. I won't take up the whole 20 minutes in order to get to leave more time for discussions. We've got quite a few people who are very knowledgeable about the issues. What I want to do is do two things. One is to fill in what Ambassador Zani said from my own personal involvement that has been tried to for a so-called diplomacy with our license effort, and also look at the situation much more analytically. When in 2004 I went to Burma for one day trip from Bangkok to meet with King Yong's deputies, Phan Chon was the chief liaison officer between the Burmese junta and Aung San Suu Kyi, and also several other close confidants of General Kim Yong. And I was at the time communicating directly with Kim Yong himself through his office. That was Kim Yong's initiative to get me into the country. At the time, they were running the military intelligence, so they were quite competent, so they figured they could sneak me in and sneak me out. But by then, that was May 2004, right up, way long after Dipeya massacre took place. And by 2003, I had already blew the whistle as probably one of the first, Burmese activists in the West, saying that the sanction strategy has backfired, and not only has it not been effective, but it has become counterproductive, both in the way of national reconciliation and in terms of our objective to weaken the regime financially. Obviously, the regime has stronger financially. So there are so many different Asian countries as well as gas and oil sector from the West. So this is not just the Asian investors embracing the regime, but gas and oil sector and mineral resource extractive sector globally has embraced this regime. So that was back in 2003. And so when we were looking at Ambassador Razali's effort, and we were getting the readings that the process was about to basically run aground because Thun Shui would overrule anything. And my understanding is that there was a deal between Kim Yong and Aung San Suu Kyi to work together. Priscilla Clamp, the chief of mission of the U.S. mission in Rangoon, wrote for the U.S. Institute of Peace, saying that there was a deal between Kim Yong and Aung San Suu Kyi to work together. And even while Aung San Suu Kyi was under house arrest, she would remain under house arrest, but she would start working with the military for reconciliation. But Thun Shui overruled. And so by then, Kim Yong had already been burned by the lobby groups in Washington, D.C. that shot down his efforts to use anti-narcotic programs as the common ground with the Americans. So senior officials within the State Department told me personally that the Burmese junta had cooperated with them and passed their test of genuine cooperation on that front, if not on democracy and human rights. But they were trying to use it as the first initial step towards renormalizing and re-engaging with the country and bring Aung San Suu Kyi along. But the the Dipeya massacre happened, and then the activist went this off. And then, of course, we were all very, very angry, and I was one of the hot-headed activists at the time as well. Back to what the ambassador Razali mentioned about the intolerance of any type of moderate thinking within the activist and Western context. Here's what I have to say. I think we have not just one layer of problem in terms of the obstacle for dialogue. Several layers, or several barriers. One is we have an activist or opposition culture or context which does not tolerate any type of independent thinking. Aung San Suu Kyi, right or wrong. And my great uncle was a close friend of her father at Rangoon University. They lived next door to each other. And I grew up looking at Aung San as my personal model as a citizen. And I used to support her, and we communicated, I wouldn't say extensively, when I was a foot soldier for her Aung San Suu Kyi campaign. And I do have affection for her personally, and I would still support her as the leader of the country if that the situation is conducive for her to become the leader or play a leading role. But I started to critique her view or what we consider, because none of us has had direct communications with her. So a lot of it is interpretation or imagination, imagining what she is thinking. And so some of the people that are boycotting today, say for instance tourism, they were using bits and pieces of what she said about 10 or 12 years ago. And we don't know where her thinking is today, because only very, very few people have the right access to her. And so if you say, you know, tourism is going to be helpful in terms of opening up the country, it's not that tourists are going to come and democratize us, but, you know, there are different dimensions of tourism that are beneficial and that are going to have a liberal impact on the society, as well as the negative impacts. That's the kind of discourse that hardcore activists and diehard supporters of the NLD and the opposition would not want to hear. And if you say, you know, like you support tourism, you're considered basically immoral because you are privileging profits above people. So that's just one example within the the opposition culture, both inside Burma and in the Burmese diaspora. And this illiberal attitude of the Burmese has become infectious, even among the Westerners and Asians who get passionate about Burma. Although they have never set foot in my country, they would assume that, you know, if someone like myself, who spent 20 years working on this issue at various personal risks, where I would be condemned or denounced as a traitor because I say boycott at this point is not working, or because like I would give reasons. And they would not come and debate in public why tourism could be helpful. They would just go around the back, and if I give an interview with the BBC, they would ring up the BBC and say, I'm working for the general. So, you know, like personal or character assassination below the belt kind of effort. And then, so that means we have an internationally illiberal policy context where activists have almost complete monopoly over the Burma discourse. If you're an activist, simple slogans are extremely effective. Aung San Suu Kyi good, generals bad. That end of discussion, and nothing could be inserted. There's no middle ground. So either you're with the generals or you're with the Aung San Suu Kyi. If you say, no, I want change, I'm not with the general, but I don't also support Aung San Suu Kyi unconditionally. There's no position for that. And so some of us try to create that space at personal cost. And then I think that space is emerging. That's why a lot of people are now talking against sanctions, against isolating, Western isolation of Burma, and yet being able to maintain their basically dignity as pro-change, anti-sanction, anti-boycott Burmese or Westerners. There are a couple of issues that I want to run through. That is related to the way we frame the Burma issues. I mean, I'm going to be less practical here because I don't think what I'm going to say is going to please the Burmese, either the generals or the opposition, can be addressed at the level of policy. We frame Burma issues as democracy issue, human rights issue, national reconciliation or lack of it. But the problem is, Burma is a post-colonial state. If you look at the nature of the state, not just in terms of the way the military controls all the institutions, virtually all institutions in the country are under the control of the military. It is a neo-totalitarian state. There are spaces, I would say. But nonetheless, in terms of the economic leverage, the cultural processes, political and communal spaces, the military has a very, very tight grip. And they run the ship very tight. I say it's a post-colonial state because the day we regained independence from Britain in 1948, that was a day for celebration for the majority or the dominant Burmese groups. But that's also the beginning of the recolonization of the ethnic groups, minorities, that makes up, 35 to 40% of the country, depending on who's counting. And also, territorially, they have a fair amount of land areas that are to be considered their ancestral land. So we have a situation where a modern nation state, where there is no single common vision. If I run into Shan or Kachin or other ethnic cohabitants of the land, and a lot of times I have a difficulty to describe them to other friends, Kachin or Chin or Shan, or do they want to be described as Burmese? And that, I think they're also self-conscious as well. Do they want to present themselves as Karen to the Burmese, or do they want to present themselves as Burmese to other foreigners? And so I think that's a framework that is going to become more and more relevant, as I don't think that the current democratization, human rights, and national reconciliation framework is going to get us anywhere, because we are ignoring the elephant in the room. The elephant is the militarized colonial state, both ethnically and in terms of military-civil relations. So what we are looking at is not just the human rights basket case, or a case where the bulk of the population lives in dire poverty. We're looking at a double colony. The Burmese military has a social relations, or the relations between the society and the military, over the past 50 years, has evolved to a point that military is a distinctive class in and of itself. It is setting up. Basically, military is looking out for its own interest. Its own rank and file members have access to different things. Better education, better healthcare facilities, better scholarship opportunities, and whichever civilian groups that would work with the military within the military's framework of national reconsolidation, they too would enjoy the kinds of things that the rank and file members would enjoy. And then that's a layer of colonialism. The military calling the shot for every single thing. And then the second aspect of the Burmese colonialism is the military / Burmese relations with ethnic minorities. From the perspective of the military, there is no need for national reconciliation. What they're doing is just basically reasserting the central control of the Burmese over the territories that they consider historically theirs. And so, therefore, if you look at the official lingo or the publications by the Burmese media, they use the word reconsolidation. They never use the word reconciliation. That's why I think both the United Nations and all the pro-change organizations and communities miss the point. The military has a vision that is radically different. The UN Security, UN General Assembly resolutions call for national reconciliation. Ban Ki-moon uses the word reconciliation. The Burmese junta does not recognize that word, nor would they accept that word. For them, it is reconsolidating. What are they reconsolidating? Reconsolidating. They are reconsolidating the militarist Burmese control, central control. And what's interesting is that some of the areas, say for instance Wa, the Wa historically have never been either part of Burma or China. These are some of the no man's lands, what we would call no man's land. They were headhunting tribes. The Burmese did not want to deal with the Wa. And the Chinese didn't claim Wa as part of their territories either. If you look at the old colonial reports from Shan states, from say like 1890s or early 20th centuries, Wa had hunting tribes. Nobody wanted them to be part of the administrative structure. They're more trouble than what's worth. So where are we going? Well, I think people talk about change being something that has to be homegrown and that has to spring from within the country, coming from the people inside that country. But I'm also a bit skeptical of this bottom-up change being solely domestically driven, because if you look at the geoeconomic and geopolitical developments in the region, these developments favor the military status quo. And part of it is, the political stability. And all the neighbors want stability, not necessarily reconciliation. As long as whoever's in power can guarantee stability, they can carry on with a business as usual attitude. There are minerals to be extracted, there could be markets that could be developed in the country. For instance, like Burma is seen as a potentially significant market, export market for a province like Yunnan, landlocked Western province. And so in that situation, we have the military that has gotten control over the past half a century. Just about every single local institutions that constitute the state. And we have a situation outside, in terms of international policy, where the Burma policy is going to remain in holding pattern for the foreseeable future. And I don't really place much hope on this new engagement and sanction from the United States either, because the Americans are wanting to get back and reinsert themselves into the Burmese scenario, primarily for two reasons. One is the growing Chinese influence. Second is the concern about the growing ties between North Korea and Burma. And so both domestic equations, despite 2010 elections and the outside geopolitical and geoeconomic situation, favor the status quo. And I'm afraid, we are going to be in this basket case scenario for quite a long time, as far as I can say. But this, I'm not happy to say this, because I'm Burmese, I want to go home, and I cannot go home. I went home finally after Kinyon was purged. I thought that being in the country, even as a classroom teacher, I could do more for the communities there, and I'd be happier, and then I'd be with my relatives and families. But there's absolutely no space. And then also, of course, I have a huge baggage as a dissident for 15 years, and so I'm 24/7 hours with them. The only place I could go without being escorted is a toilet, literally. So in that situation, there was absolutely nothing I could do. I decided that, I would not rot, in the country. If I were inside, I would not be having this discussion. I'm not willing and I'm not prepared to sit in, you know, behind bars for 20 years. And then so, I like to say, there is hope. Of course, like there is always hope. If there are people there, that we can always maintain hope. But near-term and medium-term projection, you know, I think this situation is, you know, is continue to be more or less the same. I don't have a positive message here.
Thank you. I suppose from their different starting points and personal experiences, I think both Dhanshree Ghazali and Dr. Zani have come to a similar conclusion that we have an intractable situation where the military has a gridlock on the state, and it seems as if it cannot be unlocked or unraveled. Because of the various interests of various states. And you've used the word in some of your writing, recent writings, the regressive globalization. So they were never isolated, Burma. And there have been people who've been involved with them all the time. So Burma is carrying on well. Thank you very much. The junta are in control and having a gridlock on the state. So the question now is, how do you unravel, how do you unlock the situation? And then we have the answer that Aung San Suu Kyi may not be the solution. She could very well be the problem. Unless she changes the form in which she comes to be the solution, the Gandhian form as opposed to the Nehru form. So is that going to happen? Who can make that happen? And then, of course, two things which were not mentioned, perhaps, which members might not want to come on to mention, is, of course, in recent times, Tan Sri mentioned it obliquely, nuclear weapons. When you have nuclear weapons, then there's an interest in what happens in the state and a greater engagement or involvement in trying to unravel the situation, unlock it. Of course, there have been lots of reports recently, well, not lots, a few reports recently that there might be 22 weapon sites, one or two of which might be nuclear weapons development sites, which is not proven, but there is talk of it. And even Hillary Clinton has been asked about it, so you know. And we're watching, and experts in England and so on in the past. So that's, will there be a greater engagement and interest? But the other thing that was not mentioned is ASEAN. ASEAN.
Does it have to be mentioned?
ASEAN made a strategic mistake. I want to be provocative here, by admitting Myanmar in 1997 to be a member of the international, of the regional organization, what was an international problem could be sublet to the regional institution, and now Ban Ki-moon attacked ASEAN for not taking sufficient action. When you could just say, what about you, Mr. United Nations? So, you know, coming back to that situation, it's, you know, some gridlock, and everyone is moving about, you know, aimlessly, not able to solve it. I'm sure the audience here will have views on that particular point and other matters. So shall we start with those particular points first?